My name is Zed Goldberg, and my guest is Audrey Niffenegger. Title of her book is Her Fearful Symmetry, which is more or less cadged from William Blake, but yeah, we can talk about that. And it's published by Scribner. Let me say a little bit about you first. You've lived in or near Chicago most of your life.
Yeah.
You began making prints as an artist in 1978 and trained as a visual artist in the school at the Art Institute of Chicago, which is one of the best places in the world. I have to admit that's true. Have you exhibited your artist books, paintings, and drawings at Printworks Gallery in Chicago since 87? Your first books are printed around by hand in editions of 10. That's great.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
Lots of work.
Let's see, what else? You had an idea for a book about a time traveler and his wife. There's a clue for anybody who may not know you by name. Originally intended making it as a graphic novel, but eventually realized that it's very difficult to present sudden time shifts with still images. That's true. Oh, you know, I might actually talk to you about that. What's the difference between being a novelist and being a graphic novelist in terms of the way you visualize your material and the way you present it?
Well, my main foray into graphic novels or comics has been this thing called the Night Bookmobile, which I did for the London Guardian. And I was adapting it from one of my own short stories.
Mm-hmm.
So that gave me a lot of food for thought in terms of thinking about what words do and what images do and what they do when you put them together. And the first thing I had to do was cut all the description from the text because the images were going to take that over. But of course, you can tell parallel stories. One thing can be going on in the visual part of it and something else can be happening in the written part. And together they make something completely different from either one separately.
I wrote a short story once that I thought would have made a great graphic, comic book type story. And it was very, very hard for me to visualize the action in blocks of one image after another.
Mm-hmm.
I think that skill is not necessarily transferable from one genre to the other.
Yeah, maybe not. I mean, because I'm used to drawing in little rectangles, I am able to storyboard pretty easily,
mm-hmm.
and have done it for years. So that's a natural thing that I have practiced. But if you're planning on becoming a comics artist, I think the first thing is to cultivate your visual imagination, or at least to be able to work with an artist, even if you can only draw stick figures, to kind of indicate what you...
Harvey Pekar.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's how he does it.
Yeah.
And he's certainly worked with some of the best.
Oh, yes. Anybody who works with Robert Crumb and still loves Robert Crumb has definitely got it together.
Absolutely.
Do you know Greg Rucka, by the way? Just as a,
no.
Greg Rucka is a terrific novelist and a graphic novel artist, and he lives in town here, so maybe he'll come to hear you tonight. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Well, write him down for me.
Write him down for me. We'll do that. Okay. This is Her Fearful Symmetry. Well, the Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright in the Forest of the Night. No immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry.
Mm-hmm.
But this is a novel about twins. I mean, that's what this is all about. Do you have a fascination with twins? Are there twins in your family?
There are no twins in my family. I have a longstanding interest in symmetry, of which twins, especially mirror twins, like in this book, are an outstanding example. And once I decided that there would be twins in the novel, the idea of twinning and opposites and doubling began to permeate every part of the book. And so there's nothing that happens in the book that doesn't have some kind of opposite or double.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were two twins named Elspeth and Edwina, or Edie, I suppose.
Edie, yeah.
And they're English, but had a falling out at some time in the past, and one moved to the United States, and they hardly ever spoke or wrote or communicated much with one another,
mm-hmm.
over the years. And another set of twins was born to Edwina in the United States,
mm-hmm.
and they are mirror image twins. Tell us what mirror image twins are.
It's a very rare form of identical twinning. When the embryos separate, instead of separating into two distinct and identical beings, they sort of peel away from each other in a kind of mirroring, so that one twin will have mirroring opposites. And sometimes it's quite small, like you might have a mole on the left side on one twin and on the right side on the other twin. But sometimes, as in the book, it's quite complete and one's internal organs can be reversed.
That must freak out doctors when they say that.
Yeah, it's. I think it's often a bit precarious for the mirrored twin. That sometimes that is usually the weaker twin.
You mean literally, like if the pancreas is on the right side and one will be on the left side and the other?
Yeah, that can happen. It happens more if the separation of the embryos occurs kind of later.
Mm-hmm. There was a novel, 19th century novel, The Corsican Brothers. I don't know if you know this book.
No.
It's written by one of the great, well-known 19th century novelists, naturally, whose name has flown out of my mind. But it's about two twin brothers from Corsica, hence the title, who are separated at birth. And each knows of the existence of the other, not consciously because they've never been told of it, but if one gets hit in the head, the other one feels the pain, no matter how far they're separated by distance.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, clearly it's nothing that had anything to do with this book because you haven't read the book.
No, but one of my projects with this book was to write a 21st century version of a 19th century novel,
mm-hmm.
particularly a 19th century English novel, because that's just such a particular and amazing thing. And so all these themes, the twinning, there's a whole issue about who's your daddy, and just all these things that figured so heavily in the 19th century novels, I've tried to reactivate and use. And so some reviewers have said, oh, you know, it's riddled with cliches. And it's like, yeah, that's the point. We're going to try to take the cliches and make them work.
Well, I tell people that your characters can utter cliches, but you can't. I mean, if your character says, you know, well, that hit me like a ton of bricks, that's fine. But you can't say it hit him like a ton of bricks. Is that, I mean, was that your approach here? Or did you seriously go to confronting cliches head on? Because I didn't notice it really in the book.
Oh, okay. I suppose you could say it's more of an homage than anything else, mm-hmm. in that way. And the authors I was particularly thinking about were Henry James and Wilkie Collins.
Oh yeah. I saw both of them in this book.
Okay, that's good. That's good to hear.
Well, Henry James is pretty obvious, and Wilkie Collins kind of is looming in the background because we'll get this later. It's a ghost story.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's Wilkie Collins' books are long and tedious, but it's really worth reading them.
Do you think they're tedious?
I love
bit, them.
Yeah, you know, I'm in a 20th century guy, and I hate shaggy dog stories. So,
okay.
Yeah, so it's a little. I mean, that was an evening's entertainment, and by candlelight was to sit there and read a big fat novel.
Well, the Wilkie Collins and also Dickens, they were serialized, and so it was actually the equivalent of your weekly TV show.
Oh, you see, now I didn't know that Wilkie Collins appeared serially.
Yeah, and so that's one of the reasons why every chapter kind of ends on a cliffhanger, because mm-hmm. you want to come back next week and find out
right.
what happened.
And that's like those old movie serials, those I know about.
Sure.
There are several languages being spoken by characters in this book. Come clean here. Do you know all these languages, or do you just get a lot of help with them?
Lots of help. I'm pathetic. I am absolutely useless with languages. No, I have a really close friend who's Dutch.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed a character, a woman who's leaving her husband. She needs to go far away enough from London that it's going to be hard for him to follow her. Plus, he's agoraphobic. He can't leave their apartment.
The next block would have been enough for him.
Yeah, she could have moved in next door and he would have had problems. But no, she needed to go far enough and not across the world. And I thought, yeah, you know, Amsterdam, love it. She can go there. And so she's living my fantasy of a little flat in Amsterdam where she hides out and reads books.
Amsterdam is one of those places that's both familiar and exotic at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, most Americans know very little about Amsterdam, and it seems like a place from another planet in a way.
Have you been there?
I've never been, no.
Oh, it's so beautiful. And often it's so quiet because they don't allow cars in the city center. And especially at night, you can wander around, and it just seems like it is another planet. Yeah.
That's why I love Venice so much. They don't even allow bicycles on the streets in Venice. Yeah,
that you would be dangerous to bike in Venice.
Oh,
would be.
Yeah. You turn a corner and kaboom, you bump into some person. If it's a bicycle, you're dead.
Yeah.
You get knocked into a canal or something.
You get wet.
Now, the ghost story part. Have you always been fascinated with ghost stories, or did you just take it as an intellectual challenge? Why did you decide to do a ghost story?
I've always loved them ever since I was a kid. I don't believe in ghosts,
mm-hmm.
which some people find kind of disappointing, but it's a way to think about yearning and also all this stuff that we really don't know about death. And it is such an open blank space for us, what happens after death. And of course, there's all these belief systems about it. But what's nice about the whole ghost thing is that there's centuries of literature and folk tales and all this thinking about it. And as a culture, we've somewhat agreed on what ghosts are all about. So if you're going to write about it, you can pull from all these ideas that people have come to a consensus about. Ghosts are lonely, ghosts are cold, ghosts want to eat but they can't, ghosts long to contact their loved ones. I mean, this is all kind of a no-brainer. We know this about ghosts, even though nobody can prove it. And so for a fiction writer, it's fantastic because it has this weight of a reality without actually being real.
Well, having said that and realizing that you're using pretty much all the folklore we know about ghosts or have read about ghosts, you also, there's a twist there, right? For me anyway, toward the end of the book, which I probably won't want to talk about. Maybe you don't mind, but...
Don't give away the twist.
Okay, yeah. That I found when I realized what was going on, I smacked myself in the forehead and said, "Oh my God!" You know.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, it's very good. I was very pleased with that. I'm so jaded that it's hard to surprise me anymore. But I think you did it.
Well, I think one of the reasons is that I kind of surprised myself. The book took 7 years to write, and I didn't think of the twist until I was about 5 years in. Mm-hmm. I'm slow. I'm stupidly slow. But one of the nice things about being slow is that you've got time to think of this stuff. If you don't just pump it out, you can layer things and give them a lot more complications and get to the point where you can make something that actually surprises people.
Mm-hmm. Well, people who put out 3 or 4 books a year just scare the hell out of me. So I like you.
Thank you.
That's good. As I was reading this, it seemed there were a couple of themes and a couple of... what's the word I'm looking for? Relationships between characters that seem to be mirroring one another, just like the idea of the mirror image twins. Is it possible for one person to thrive without being at another's expense? It seems in this book there's some of that going on.
In this book, there's this constant tension between individuality and coupledom. And some of the characters are better off by themselves. Some are better off together. And I would say that every character pretty much gets what they deserve, as in a 19th century novel. You're making a face.
Yeah. I think somebody got away scot-free, so to speak. that was the twist that really, you know, that really got to me. But yeah. That's fine. I mean, and not everything is supposed to be tied up in a neat little bow, is it?
No. What I'm looking for is complications, ambiguity, points where the reader has to decide for themselves, which makes some readers crazy. And then they write me an email freaking out about it. But what I really love are these books where it's not all tidy, it's not all formulaic, it doesn't do what you expect, and it still feels true.
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly managed to succeed in that.
Thank you.
Let me remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Audrey Niffenegger. I'm going to spell your last name. Niffenegger. Title of the book is Her Fearful Symmetry. Scribner is the publisher. Let's talk about Julia and Valentina, who are, in fact, the mirror twins. They're young. They're about 20 years old. They're American-born, although their mother is English, and one of the twins that we were talking about earlier. They are slender, blonde, very adorable, and so attached to each other that, in fact, you would think they were more like two halves of the same personality or two personalities in one body rather than mirror twins. Is that a fair description?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
They go to England because – can I say this? Can I tell – yes.
Yeah, they've inherited – the first thing that happens in the book is that a woman named Elizabeth Noblin dies, and her twin – Edie lives in Lake Forest, Illinois, and is the mother of Julia and Valentina. And so one fine day, Julia and Valentina get a letter totally out of the blue that tells them that they've inherited this flat and lots of money from their aunt, who they didn't know. And the conditions are that they have to go live in the flat for a year before they can sell it or do anything with it, and that their parents can never set foot in it. And so immediately... You know, you set up a, you know, dun-dun-dun, something's secret, something's wrong. And so the rest of the book involves Julia and Valentina actually going to London and trying to make a life for themselves. And there is a tension between the twins because they're just on the cusp of adulthood. And one of them, Valentina, wants to have a life, wants to make decisions for herself, wants to separate a little bit at least. And the more she does that, the more Julia, her twin, tries to hang on.
Well, the thing that's interesting about them is that outwardly, Julia is the more outgoing one and Valentina is the more inward and reserved one. But she's really, I mean, Julia calls her mouse.
She is a mouse.
Yeah.
At least at the beginning.
Yeah. And but it's really Valentina, the one that has the urge to become an individual person.
Don't you find, though, that the quiet people sometimes are the ones with the steely determination?
Well, that's the folklore, but it's not always true in my experience.
Not always. But if you've been dominated all your life, you might have an urge to get out.
Yes, that's certainly true. I like them. I like them a lot. Even because anybody who's had a sibling or knows a pair of close siblings will see the dynamic going on between them as being not only normal but probably expected from people as close as that. But each of them finds someone in London, actually in the apartment house they live in,
mm-hmm.
To help grease the separation, for want of a better phraseology. That's not really right, but makes the first crack in their mm-hmm. separation. There's Robert and there's Martin. You mentioned the Dutch woman before. She's Marijke. She's married to Martin,
yeah.
And she leaves him because he's become an agoraphobe and just a phobic in general, and his place looks like the Collier Mansion. Tell us about Martin's apartment.
Yeah, Martin's apartment is full of boxes, and in the boxes are many, many of the couple's possessions, which he's wrapped in plastic and sealed with tape and put in boxes and stacked up. And he's trying to separate himself from anxiety and emotion, and he's doing this by quarantining objects and also by doing a lot of counting and washing and all the
obsessive compulsive
OCD things that people mm-hmm. do. And and he's a very self-aware person, so it's not like he's oblivious to what's going on or what this means, but he also feels powerless to deal with it.
Can't help himself.
Right.
And Marijke, they're both bright, intelligent, thinking people. Mm-hmm. She just can't take it anymore one day. And she says, look, you know, I got to get out of here or I'm going to go as nuts as you are. And that leaves Martin bereft.
They're both very sad about it. They love each other. They're in their mid-50s and they've been married for decades.
Mm-hmm.
But she realizes on some level that she's just enabling him. So that's part of her decision to leave.
Julia attaches herself to him.
Julia does. They meet by accident. I won't tell you what the accident is.
Neither will I.
Anyway, she manages to meet this guy who never leaves his apartment. And she is the age of Martin and Marijke's son. And so Martin happily relates to her almost as though she's a child. And they begin a friendship, which is actually pretty positive for both of them. Meanwhile, Valentina has managed to meet Robert, who lives in the ground floor flat and who was their aunt's lover. And that relationship is a bit more fraught and peculiar because Robert's...
Fraught and peculiar.
He's not the most together dude. He's, for one thing, he's very deeply grieving for Elsbeth, so that complicates his feelings toward the world and everyone in it.
And certainly her niece.
Absolutely, because yeah. the younger set of twins looks a great deal like their aunt and their mother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people remark about that constantly through the book. The first time they see them, it was, my God, you look just like Elsbeth.
Mm-hmm.
Are Robert and Martin mirror images of one another in a way?
On certain levels, they are opposites. Robert is always out and about. He's a tour guide at the cemetery that they live next to.
But he's constrained by his neurosis almost as badly as Martin is physically.
Yeah. I mean, Martin is actually a fairly healthy person emotionally and very giving. Robert is a mess. But Robert is able to go out and be in the world in a way that Martin can't do.
Mm-hmm. There's a geographical feature in London, Highgate Cemetery, which is practically a character in this book.
Mm-hmm.
It is where Robert works. The block of flats that they live in is right next to the cemetery,
mm-hmm.
overlooks the cemetery, in fact.
Yeah, they share a back wall, and they have a little door that they can actually go in the cemetery, which is a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
There are actually two houses.
You
that
were
have
a guide it. There for a while, weren't you?
I still am, yeah. Whenever I can get over there, yeah.
So what's that like? I mean, you know, give me a couple of sentences on what it's like to take tours through, in fact, the graveyard.
It's really phenomenal because the graveyard is like a narrative. And as the guide, you're telling the story of the graveyard. And people mainly come because they want to see. And so what you're supplying is the things they can't see. And so you're telling them why the things they're looking at are interesting or what happened before that moment that they're standing there.
There's a photograph of me standing at the tomb of Karl Marx, so which I cherish because it was the first time I went to London. And I went there for several reasons, and all of them involved people whose tombs were there.
Yeah.
And Robert works there. He's a guide there.
Mm-hmm.
And Highgate... It looms in this book as mm-hmm. as a place that affects everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. When I first began the book, it was going to be set in Chicago in a neighborhood called Uptown.
Mm-hmm.
And I started with Martin. I had this idea of a man who can't leave his apartment and this girl who visits him all the time. And for no particularly good reason, it was in Uptown. And Uptown is wrapped around a cemetery called Graceland. And so I just thought, oh, yeah, you know, they're on the edge of Graceland, and I could visualize it. And then once there was a cemetery, I thought, well, is that the optimal cemetery? And I thought, well, the coolest, best one I've ever been to is Highgate, so what if we just take the whole thing and throw it over the ocean into London?
The best surprise going to Highgate Cemetery is the statue of Dick Whittington's cat, which is outside the gates of the cemetery on one of the streets at the edge of the cemetery. That's
yeah.
Area. Because I don't know, does anybody know that anymore about Turnagain Dick Whittington, Lord Mayor of London? I mean, is that...
Well, if you're British, you know it. If you're American, you've never heard that in your life.
yeah. It's about a cat that rid a ship of rats. And the Pasha, or whoever it was, who owned the ship, in gratitude, gave Dick Whittington tons of money, and he became the Lord Mayor of London. And he was ready to quit, so he was on his way out when he heard the bells saying, turn again, Dick
Whittington.
Turn
again, yeah. Yeah, the statue of the cat has little bare spots where people have rubbed it for luck.
There was a little cage around it when I was there. Still,
yeah, I think that's just so people don't run into it with their bikes or something.
Worm their hands through the bars and rub the cat. Huh?
Yeah.
When you conceived this book, it took you 7 years to do it. So I guess there was an ongoing conception. It was an evolution as you were doing it. Did you have any idea how it was? I mean, you've already told us it wasn't even set in London. Do you still surprise yourself when you write?
Oh, absolutely. And my goal is not to know everything at the beginning. I don't know if you could even. It's much more interesting to set on a path where you don't know what the result will be and follow it and just see what happens. And I guess I don't know how to do it any other way than to just embark and find out. And one of the delightful things about doing the research for this book was that there was so much more, not only in Highgate Cemetery, but in London itself. I had mainly known London through books, and so there was this kind of literary overlay. And then when I started going there a lot, the literary overlay was still there, but the reality started to exist substantially for me.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully that made it into my book, and maybe my book will inspire some people to go over there and experience things that are in the book, and then that will become real for them.
Yeah, whatever you hear about Soho, whatever you hear about Buckingham Palace, actually looking at it and walking through it is a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, as we were talking before we went on and started recording, I was an Anglophile, still am, and when I got to England, I realized how pathetically little I actually knew about English culture, so...
Yeah, I mean, just listen to the BBC.
Yeah. as we do here in Portland, it's on quite a lot on our local radio. What are you working on now, or don't you like to talk about it?
Well, I don't mind. I'm not doing a whole lot of work these days. Sooner or later, I'll go home and actually roll up my sleeves. But
well, you're on book tour. Where are you on the tour? Beginning, middle, end?
The last bit of it is sometime in the middle of summer.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's slowing down a little bit now, but I get to go to festivals. Anyway, what I'm working on when I finally get to work is a novel called The Chinchilla Girl in Exile. It's about a 9-year-old girl who has hypertrichosis, which means she's covered in hair.
Aye.
And she's very beautiful, you know, she's kind of kitten-like. But at the same time, that's a hard row to hoe if you're a little girl. And so mainly what I want to write about is what it's like to be very different and how children treat each other when they're very different and just what it's like to exist in the world when people can instantly look at you and make judgments about you based on your appearance.
It seems to me that you've written three books. One is, or you're in the process of writing a third. One is about time travel. One is about ghosts and mirror image twins. And the next one is about a little girl covered in hair. It occurs to me you're not going to be writing a conventional novel anytime soon.
Alas, no, I am not John Updike and never shall be.
Well, one was enough, I think. So
yeah, you know, other people have got that covered. You know, reality is taken care of.
I want to say one more thing about the ghosts, and if this is too much, in the book appears two things which are part of the folklore of ghosts. One is a Ouija board, mm-hmm. and the other is automatic writing. And this is the way Elspeth manifests herself to her friends. That was the way you built that, starting with Elspeth's earliest attempts to. Manifest herself to herself and as an entity, mm-hmm. and right up through the end with that horrifying twist at the end. I thought that was just brilliantly done.
Thank you.
I know there's not what else can you say, right?
The listeners won't know what the heck we're talking about, but
well, they should go out and buy the book.
Nice to hear that.
Yeah. In fact, let me tell them what book this is. It's been delightful talking to you. Audrey Niffenegger is the author, Niffenegger. Her Fearful Symmetry, published by Scribner. I hope you'll come back to Portland with your next book and I can talk to you again.
Oh, absolutely. Portland is just the bee's knees.
The bee's, and yeah. Thank you.